order the House Committee on Human Services on Wednesday, February 11th, 2009. And I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2051. Sheila, you want to tell us about that?
This creates a general assistance program in the Department of Human Services for Oregon residents who are pursuing supplemental Social Security income or Social Security disability benefits. And provides them with cash assistance and medical assistance and case management to help them get through that process.
Great. Thank you, Keely. So, do we have a list?
We do. It is that.
Okay, great. So, we have Deanna Hartwig, Jeanette Burkett, am I pronouncing that anyway close, and John Mullen. Good morning. There's a sign-up sheet over there if anyone cares to sign up, whose name we do not now have.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I am Deanna Hartwig, the Administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services, and I'm here to testify today on House Bill 2051. As you know, this bill would require the Department of Human Services to design, implement, and maintain a general assistance program. This program would serve individuals without dependent children who are unable to work due to physical or mental disabilities. The program would also provide them with a monthly cash benefit, $314 a month, access to the Oregon Health Plan Plus medical benefits, and case management services to assist them in continuing with their applications to Social Security and working through any denial process that may result from their application to that agency. The department last testified on general assistance in September in front of a joint House and Senate interim subcommittee on senior and people with disabilities. Some of you may recall that particular policy option package testimony. I want to point out that what we presented at that time does vary from what I'm going to speak to today. So I just wanted to remind you that when we came before that subcommittee, interim committee last time, we were anticipating that approximately 1,500 individuals would come into this general assistance program at a cost of about $5 million for the cash grant, $3 million for staffing to support the program, and $27 million in Oregon Health Plan Plus costs. And that was described in our 2009-11 policy option package. At the request of the Oregon Law Commission and the Oregon Food Bank, seniors and people with disabilities, in conjunction with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the Department's Forecasting Unit, took another look at that prior general assistance program and also what was happening with our presumptive Medicaid disability program. And I think the primary difference in what we told you in September and what you will hear today is that we believe most of the individuals who would present for general assistance, the cash benefit, are probably included in the folks coming to presumptive Medicaid for a decision of disability in order to receive the Oregon Health Plan. So we do not believe that those $27 million in Oregon Health Plan additional costs are really additional. They're part of that forecast that's been built into that part of the department. So our current assumptions are based on recent data, which shows a very significant increase in people who are applying for presumptive Medicaid. So applications come into the local office. They're sent to staff in the senior people with disabilities who make that determination. The individuals are making application to Social Security Administration at the same time for either the supplemental security income or Social Security disability insurance. So we're still pairing up the process of getting a medical card based on disability and making application for those Social Security Administration benefits. That caseload is now about 3,000 individuals. When the prior GA program closed, it was serving a couple hundred individuals, and at its highest, it was about 3,000. So that's another reason we think that due to some of the conditions that people are facing these days, they are already coming in for those very needed medical benefits. So we have some recommendations to the bill that will more closely align the program with our presumptive Medicaid program so that we're using exactly the same criteria that Social Security uses to determine disability, which is what my staff do today, and a couple other things that we think will enhance our ability to recover from the Social Security benefits once they are awarded. We think the General Assistance Program will bring some new clients, as well as providing additional benefits for those presumptive Medicaid clients today. Those individuals in general would be available for the cash grant. So the cost analysis that I'll get to in a little bit is based on those individuals. The presumptive Medicaid program does serve individuals very much like the ones that this bill wishes to have served. The majority are impoverished. They're unable to meet their basic needs. They're often homeless, between residences or institutions, and have significant barriers to health care and social services. They need more individualized assistance and additional consideration when it comes to understanding program requirements, how to fill out the applications, keeping deadlines, getting to appointments, and cooperating in general with the process of becoming eligible. So given the size and unique difficulties faced by this population, the Senior and People with Disabilities field offices do require some additional staff to screen these applicants. When they come into our office, we screen them for both disability and non-disabled programs. We look at any programs they might be eligible for as we move them through the process for a presumptive Medicaid determination. So we actually modeled the cost of this program more along those lines than we had prior to September when we presented the information. So based on the new forecast, we believe about 5,200 clients would be served during the 2009-11 biennium. And the program costs are as follows. It's about a $36 million total fund program. The majority of that, about $30 million, would go to the cash grant for the individuals on the presumptive Medicaid program today. We have about $4 million in staffing costs, which also bring in almost $3 million in federal funds for the staff. Looking ahead to the next biennium, 2011-13, we anticipate about 4,000 individuals would present through the General Assistance Combination Presumptive Medicaid Program. We believe that individuals will be leaving General Assistance because they're getting their Social Security award, which takes about 20 to 22 months after application to actually come in. So we'll be seeing more people leaving matched by people coming in. That's one of the reasons the forecast is a bit smaller. Also, I'd like to point out that during that time period, we will begin to see the recovery come in. The cost for the 11-13 biennium is about $38 million. We have a cash grant in general fund of about $8 million. That's matched by $23 million in recovery, and that's based on the award of Social Security benefits. The state recovers their cash monthly benefit first, and any remainder money goes to the individual. And our staffing costs are about $4 million in general fund and another $2 million in federal fund. So that we think this bill, with some minor suggestions, really represents good public policy. As you know, however, it's not in the governor's recommended budget. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
I'm going to ask a question. I'm a little bit confused about the figures for the two biennia. So $36 million for this from 09-07 and almost $38 for 11-13. So if you're getting federal funds, and that would be $23 million, correct?
Correct.
So it seems then we would be covering now the backload of people for whom we haven't provided services for many years, correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, our original thoughts were that offering a cash grant would bring more people in than we had seen. I think that we have taken a different view of that and believe that the presumptive Medicaid caseload, which is projected to go up, as I indicated, to 5,200 and down to 4,000, is really going to capture all of those individuals. So if we take an application in January, find the person disabled, give them a medical card, they apply to Social Security, we won't see a recovery on our cash grant for at least 20 months or more.
Right.
So we won't see any recovery at all. So one of the differences in the general fund impact is the recovery coming in. If we didn't have recovery, the cash grant for the subsequent biennium would actually be about $31 to $32 million. So the cash grant costs are running about the same. That's based on caseload. So did that answer your question?
Oh, I see. That $23 million is included in that $38 million.
Right.
Got
we're going to use that to backfill the general fund for the cash grant.
Great. Any further questions?
I just have a quick question on history of general assistance. How long was it in place before it was ended in 2005?
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, it's in my testimony. There's a briefing.
John, could you identify yourself?
Thank you very much. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. In the packet that I submitted, there's information about the history of it, and basically it was ended in January of 2005, but it also closed down for a while in 2003, yes. And a new, more difficult-to-manage program was established for a short period of time when we had a very small case. But GA, as I mentioned in my testimony, really goes back to the Depression era of services that states provided, generally called relief programs.
Thank you.
Representative Dunbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell us something about the length of time that it takes for someone to, once they have made an application to SSI, to start getting their benefits? I've heard really varying estimates of how long the process actually takes.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrow. In Oregon, it's taking 22 months for Social Security Administration to make a decision. For individuals who present to my presumptive Medicaid Disability Determination Unit to determine if they have a disability that would qualify them for the medical card, it takes an average of 83 days for us to at least get the medical card out to folks.
Mm-hmm. And then as much as 2 years for federal dollars to start flowing?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrough, that's correct. Which is why in our analysis you will see we're not even indicating recovery until the biennium that begins 2011 to 2013.
One last follow-up. So currently many of these people are going without any kind of funds while they're waiting for the federal funds to kick in?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembrough, that is correct. The General Assistance Program is designed to give them a small cash grant to assist them while they're waiting for those benefits to arrive.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you so much. John, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm very pleased to be here today to talk about general assistance. The Oregon Law Center, as I believe all of you realize, works on justice issues for the low-income communities in the state of Oregon. In our offices all around the state, people are coming into to talk about the issues that they face, poverty, disability, lack of services, and so forth. And this is why the General Assistance Program continues to be a major priority for the Oregon Law Center. We have worked with a number of different groups, the Campaign for Seniors and People with Disabilities, and also the General Assistance Coalition, and Stephanie Thomas-Sweet will be up here later on, and I think we've done a really terrific job with getting a number of other organizations and individuals interested in general assistance. As you may recall, back in 2007, there were really just a handful of us working on that. But I did attach a briefing paper on general assistance, which I won't go over. A number of you have seen earlier versions of this, but I'd be happy to answer any questions about it. But I just want to say that we really appreciate the support in the 2007 session of this committee, and a couple of members that weren't there, I decided to go back and revisit 2007. You may recall that Representative Kotek, for those of you who are here, talked about this being a moral issue about restoring this program. But then also Representative Vic Gilliam also spoke up and said that as far as he was concerned, he didn't know why legislators were here if they weren't here to solve problems like this, like the General Assistance Program working with the poorest of the poor. But what sprang from that, even though we didn't get beyond Ways and Means, had strong support from the committee, was that Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette took up the whole issue of senior and disability issues and included in Senate Bill 1061 the idea of costing out the General Assistance Program. And, of course, that's what we're doing, working with SPD and bringing this discussion back to you today. In summary, of course, we just see this as being a really important program. Some of you know, I was the director for many years of Clackamas County Social Services. We had the general assistance program there. And all of you know from your experience in your local communities, you see people in your local communities that fit this profile. And very often they're unaccompanied single people. You see them out on the street, no visible means of support, often not very well served at all by any organization. If they're not on the Oregon Health Plan, they're not getting mental health services. They often wind up in jails and in emergency rooms and so forth. But basically, from a very much a heartfelt position, these are people that are really suffering in every community around the state. So we really very much appreciate your consideration. And I would also say we really appreciate having worked with seniors and people with disabilities. As you may recall, we had a little sticking point about the Oregon Health Plan numbers, but we have come to consensus around that. And what we would ask the chair and the committee is for your consideration for us to have a small work group to take a look at how this bill can be improved along the lines of the presumptive eligibility. And there are a couple of other things that we could discuss productively with SPD. And I guess the last note that I would add in my testimony is just the deep recognition of how difficult your job is this session. As in my other role as co-chair of the Human Services Coalition, we led off the discussion last night about human service issues before Ways and Means Committee. We know that these are very difficult times even to maintain existing programs. Still, though, we feel it is important for you to have an opportunity to weigh all of these things out in consideration, to think about what kinds of programs and bills you will be forwarding onto the Ways and Means Committee. So again, we would be happy to work along with this in a work group if that's your wishes, but we very much appreciate being here today, and I know you're going to hear some very heartfelt testimony from others that are here today. With that, I'll say thank you and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. Any questions of this witness? I guess I'd like to point out, colleagues, that I think some of these people in the audience, including these two, stayed here all night last night because I think they were here late last night at the hearing for Ways and Means. So thank you all for being here. Did Jeanette come in? Okay. And Stephanie Thomas-Sweet and Nicole Palmatier-Armstrong. Jeanette, I think you were first on the list. If you want to introduce yourself and just proceed.
Good morning. With great respect, ladies and gentlemen of the Legislative Board of Oregon and all others present, I ask that you hear my concerns regarding House Bill 2051. I believe with all my heart that the passing of this proposal is vital to the health and well-being of Oregon citizens. There are many people within this state who are unable to properly care for themselves. The waiting period for approval for Social Security benefits is a very prolonged process. Oregon rates as one of the slowest states for approval. Currently, there is little to no help for those who have become disabled. Too many people are without any medical care, rehabilitative services, and any financial support. They are unable to sustain their current health and well-being. They have little hope of stability without help. With little or no help, this leaves the portion of our communities with few or no options that are sustainable. For some, this creates bad options and the rise of criminal activities coupled with more mental and emotional illnesses. The effect of no helpful social programs and no medical care increases the difficulty of going through the required processes to obtain any Social Security. Many lose the will to live and stop caring about their communities. Social and mental health offices are overwhelmed on a daily basis with people pleading for help. Charitable organizations and soup kitchens cannot offer enough support or open up new places in needful areas to support the needs of our communities. Too many families in the state of Oregon have been affected through this dilemma, whether it is within their jobs, on the street, within their own families and circle of friends. People are crying out for help. Who will help those who cannot help themselves? Where is the heart of Oregon? Please excuse me.
Sure.
I did not get my draft finalized.
That's all right.
Will you sit back and watch these citizens die? Or will you hope that they just go away ashamed or move to another state that will help them? And if these people migrate to other states for help, then how will those legislative leaders look at the state of Oregon and its legislative leaders, as well as its citizens? Nobody wants to be a burden. If all those who need help were gone because they could not receive a hand up, would your conscience feel good? Or would you have calloused hearts and say, oh well, and try to wash your hands of it? Oregonians will remember. If new people take their place, who will vote for you? Those who do not care? I, for one, do not want a bitter Oregon. I want a better Oregon. I respectfully and humbly ask you, please grant the passage of House Bill 2051. With your help, perhaps some of those who need help might be able to once again become productive people. With medical help, some will get well. Please don't ignore those who need help. You might be saving someone who one day might save you. No one is exempt from fate. Oregon citizens are people, not just voting tabulations. Can you save a life today or make one better?
Jeanette, tell us your story. Tell us why you're interested in this bill.
I have a personal stake in this. I myself am disabled. Life is very difficult. If it were not for the help of close friends who took me in, I probably would not be here. I have been without medical care and without my prescriptions for many months. Some days are better than others, and some days are very non-functional and very emotional. It's hard to have a balance and a good outlook. It's hard to hope sometimes. But I believe in Oregon. I believe in its people. This is my home. And I trust and pray for better things. And I know that at some point, it will get better. I will not give up. I will not. I believe with proper medical care and treatment, I can get well and once again become productive. And no matter what your decision is, I will hold that hope.
Thank you very much.
I thank you for hearing me.
Thank you for coming. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Let's see. Stephanie?
Sure. Can I sit down? Can you? Madam Chair, Tomei, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank. And I'm providing testimony today in support of the General Assistance Program. Oregon Food Bank has been the lead convener of a group to restore the program for the last several months. We worked in the last session with several of you to restore the program and have been working in the intervening months here to speak with several of you. So I know that you're familiar with our work and the program. But quick overview is Oregon Food Bank is the hub of a statewide network of 20 regional food banks and 919 local agencies. And our mission statement is to eliminate hunger and its root causes because no one should be hungry. And our main priorities are obviously related to food most often, but we are also committed to addressing the reasons why people are accessing emergency food boxes in the first place. And every year we conduct surveys, focus groups, through a Voices project across the state where we have in-depth interviews with clients. And we also conduct a more quantitative or quantitative survey through a hunger factor survey to get information on the statistics of why people are accessing emergency food. And through both of these surveys, we're able to hear the stories from folks about what their experiences are. And I was able to participate in some of these this fall and can tell you how moving it is to hear the stories from people and how often people with disabilities are sharing their stories of how they are not able to have assistance in the meantime while they're applying for federal benefits and come to the food bank because they don't have anywhere else to go. In our last year's Hunger Factor survey of about 3,900 clients surveyed, 22% reported having a disability that prevented them from working. And many of these individuals are currently seeking federal SSI and SSDI benefits. As you know, the average wait time from application to receipt of benefits is about 30 months. It's a very complex, lengthy process that many people are turned away from the first time. And like I said, people turn to us in the meantime in this gap period where there's absolutely no safety net for them or assistance from the state. And just a quick update on our food banks is that last week we got our updates from our second quarterly report and are seeing increases of up to 15% across the state between July 1st and December 30th, 2008, compared to the same period in 2007. And some areas of the state have seen up to 40% increases in access for emergency food. And we just know that folks who have disabilities are severely impacted by the economic crisis and by these rises in the access for emergency food. So I won't take a lot longer, but I did want to mention on, I believe that each of you received a handout sheet that just has some quick bullet points, and it also includes the coalition members that we have who are working on this program, and I won't name them all because you have them in front of you, but really want to highlight the fact that it's a very diverse group of organizations, cross-cutting from hunger and food agencies like my agency, and then also housing groups, faith-based groups, senior citizens, people with disabilities. It's a very broad and diverse coalition, and I think this just attests to the fact that people who are in need of general assistance it's a very broad and cross-cutting need that hits many sectors in our society. So, and you'll hear from several of those clients today. And in closing, we recipients of general assistance are often referred to as the poorest of the poor. General assistance would provide these individuals with a monthly cash grant to provide for their basic survival skills, things like toothpaste, soap, shampoo, basic dignity items, and it's also cost-effective for programs since the state is reimbursed by the federal government. So Oregon Food Bank and our coalition members are very honored to present to you today. We thank you for your time, and I'm happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions? We have a lot of people testifying this morning, and I just want to make sure everybody has the time. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Armstrong. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging. We're here to testify in support of general assistance. When the program was functioning back in the day, the program was ran through the area agencies at the local level. So we've had that firsthand experience of seeing these individuals coming in who need this kind of help. We really are talking about a life preserver program for people who are single, childless, who have the inability to access any other kinds of benefits, whether that's unemployment or veterans benefit. All of those things are not an option in order to be eligible for general assistance. So as Stephanie pointed out, we're really talking about the very poorest of the poor. And I thought it was interesting, Representative Dembrow asked what happens to the people at this time, and I would say we have those questions, and we have no options to offer them. We have no help to give them right now, and they often, as you might say, fall off the grid, go back into the trees, leave society because there are no other options. And it sounds drastic, it sounds dramatic, but it is in fact the case. If you think about it, I think that it would be very reasonable to say that any individual with very few resources is just one incident away from being in the kind of position where you would have no other financial ability to be able to buy basic food, buy basic things to keep yourself functioning on a day-to-day basis. And when you're in that kind of a precarious position, it makes it virtually impossible to find your way out of it without a little bit of help. You can't find a place to live. You can't find even a temporary place to stay without some sort of deposit or some sort of funds. And so you find yourself in this very vicious, vicious cycle. General assistance was a way to help people try to start breaking out of that while waiting for hopefully some federal benefits to come. And certainly, unfortunately, that need is increasing. We support general assistance, and we thank you for your consideration of this program and of this bill, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Nicole. Any quick questions of this witness?
I'll have some, but maybe I should save them up.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's fine. And we can call witnesses back up if your answers aren't questions aren't answered by the end of the testimonies. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm calling up the next three: Melanie Calvin, Nick Granum, Myrn Eaton, and Stephen Powell. And we have quite a few people who have listed that they would like to testify, so I'm going to ask you to maybe speak 3 minutes at the most, and I'll try to keep track of that. Thank you so much for coming. And the only thing that is required of you is to give your story, and first of all, give us your name, please. Go ahead, sir. Sure.
Ms. Chairperson, tell me, my name is Stephen Powell. I live in Portland. I'm 57 years old. And I've been homeless 10 or 15 years in Portland. And I've had SEP to join, and people help me get off the streets. And living in the streets is not easy. I've got arthritis, early 90s, and then when I got my arthritis, it deformed my hands and my back and stuff, and I've had a hard time being able to get a job. People turn me down when I try, and then I lived in the hills, because if you go to the shelters, you end up coming out with lice and stuff like that, where I wouldn't go. And so
tell him what a day life was like for you.
Oh, what life was? Well, you know, looking for cans or a little scrap metal or any kind of thing you can make a dollar with is not easy, because there's so many people out there doing it, you know. So you might live on $2 or $3 or $10 a day, you know. Not easy living in the streets. And, you know, getting some assistance does help.
How did you sustain your camp for that many years?
In camp, yeah. That's, well, I know I rode a bike and got around collecting cans and stuff, but I lived up in the hills because that's the only place where people didn't come up, and I wasn't harassed by police or anything like that, and I just barely got by. And then with the pain that I had to get around on, wasn't easy. I don't know how to address you. I'm sorry.
You're doing fine. Absolutely.
But,
do you want me to throw in a couple more details that I know about you?
Go ahead.
Is that okay?
Sure. Okay. Introduce yourself first.
Hi, I'm Melanie Calvin from Central City Concern. I brought Stephen down because he was a hard-working warehouse supervisor for a lot of years, construction, remodeling, and when his arthritis struck him to the point where he could no longer work, he kept trying to look for a job. And every time he'd walk into an employer, he'd show his hands and they wouldn't hire him. And he sort of mentioned that already. It took us 5 years to get Mr. Powell out of the woods because of lack of housing, transitional housing. About 50 vouchers came up a few years ago, and Stephen was on the top of our list. So he the little bit of money that he was able to raise, he was able to keep fuel for his camp stove and a little bit of soap and toilet paper and that kind of thing. And oddly enough, it was kind of hard to get to him because he was really high up in the hills of Forest Park. It was a long hike every day for him to come out and find a way for him to scrape up a little bit of money. So I really thank him for coming down today.
Only one man from Joyne that had enough guts to go up that hill every day to try to help me.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I think that's about all I get to say. I don't know what else to say.
Thank you so much for coming and telling us about
Thank
yourself.
You. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Chelmerson. I'm Madam Chairperson told me. My name is Myrn Eaton. I go... Almost everybody knows me as Bud. I'm 61 years old. I spent over 35 years as a long-haul truck driver. Raised three kids as a single parent. And I just basically, I wore my back out. Wrestling freight around, packing 100-pound tarps, chains and stuff, and I just got, you know, well, I was still able to do it. I'd worked 12 years for this one man, boss, best boss I ever had, and then he was just very inconsiderate. He went and died on me. If he hadn't done that, I'd have still been working for him if I could. Best man I ever worked for, best friend I ever had. But he died, and that blew that business. Well, I tried dump trucking for a year and a half. Excuse me. They starved me out on that. And, like I said, I just couldn't do the heavy work anymore. I moved up to Washington when I got tired of being hungry down here, tried to dump truck. And I lived with my sister for 2 months. That's where I got my last job. I got another long hauling job. And I worked at that for a month. And then they soon realized that I just couldn't do it. I couldn't pick up that 100 pounds chin high and put tarps up on the trailer and stuff. So they had to let me go. They gave me a try. But I realized myself at that time that I wasn't going to be able to do it. So I went ahead and I started buying camp and stuff. I bought me a big tarp that eventually I turned into a tent. I bought me a mummy bag so I could stay warm at night. And then after I lost that job and I couldn't pay my sister any more rent because she lived up there, she kicked me out, so I moved into the woods. And I had a little bit of money left over, so I was very frugal living in the woods up there. I didn't try and get on any food stamps. I don't know if Washington has them or not. But I just, like I say, I lived in the woods for 6 months. I'd pilfer wood off stores when they weren't looking so I could have a campfire at night when I was cold enough. My children, who were all here in Portland, they didn't know where I was, and when they finally got hold of my sister, she says, hell, I don't know, and I don't care. He can't pay rent. He can't stay here. Well, they were mounting a search party to come looking for me, and about that time, I had managed to hitchhike my way back to Portland, and I just turned up. They were leaving on Friday night to come looking for me up there. And I showed up on Thursday night. And so I couch surfed from then with my kids, between my stepdaughter and my youngest daughter. I couch surfed with them for a year and a half, made my money picking up cans, selling scrap, hitting, you know, that's for smoking material and whatever I needed, soap, razors, toilet paper. I got on food stamps, and I just basically, whichever daughter I was living with, I gave her my food stamps because I was living with them. I couldn't pay any money, so I paid for my being there with by giving them my food stamps. And like I said, I picked up cans and stuff for my tobacco, and it was tough. But $315 a month would have meant a lot to me. I could have paid some for rent and still had money left to buy, like I say, razors and laundry soap and shampoo, whatever I needed.
But have you applied for SSI?
I did when I came back here to Portland. I was getting to that. I had got pretty heavy into drinking because I gave up on life. And I went into Hooper here in Portland to try and get away from it. So I knew I was just trying to kill myself, and I was too chicken to shoot myself, so I figured I'd drink myself to death, which I've done a pretty good job of it. But I went into Hooper because I didn't want to live that way, and got into clean and sober housing, and one of my counselors put me in touch with Melanie here, and she helped me get medical, which I was never able to get before that. And then after that, I got on, she helped me get SSI, and I've got a room now for permanent housing and my SSI, but still, again, I'm worse off than I was with SSI than I was before I got it. Before I got it, I could make $1,100 a month, and I could get a full month's supply of food stamps. Now that I'm only getting $670 a month off SSI, all I'm allowed is $10 a month food stamps. Well, I've got to pay my rent and still buy all of my stuff, my food and everything else with what's left. And like I say, before I got on SSA, I could make $1,100 a month and still get $150-some-odd a month food stamps.
But I'm a little bit confused because I thought the whole point of this was to encourage people and enable people to get on SSI, and yet I'm hearing from you that that's not the answer that we had hoped it would be.
Yeah, you know, it's tough. It is.
I know. Mella, do you want to address that?
Yes. Bud, that earning $1,100 a month is if you could still work.
If you could still work.
Yeah.
Which I can't do.
Right. So, yeah, you weren't able to earn that $1,100 a month, so the SSI
No, I picked up cans. And
yeah, right. Thank you so much for coming to tell us your story, Bud. Do you have anything more to add quickly, Melanie?
Yes, and I will. I did have a statement here. I'll read it quickly because I know we're short on time. It's wonderful to see you, Chairperson.
Thank you.
I'm really happy to be here again. I was able to testify at the last hearing, and I brought a couple of other clients back then. I'm an SSI Medicaid specialist for Central City Concern. I've been a Social Security disability advocate for 8 years now, and I really love my work. My first 3.5 years were working as a paralegal for an attorney that specialized in disability claims. I'm also a trainer for social workers and case managers, disability advocates, and lay representatives to teach them how to navigate the Social Security disability system. I teach a federally sponsored model, a highly successful model known as the SSI-SSD Outreach Access and Recovery Model, and we call that SOAR. SOAR was a federal initiative that was rolled out thanks to SAMHSA money a few years ago. In these last 8 years, I've represented or consulted on close to 1,000 disability claims. This last year has been particularly exciting for me as I've been able to help Central City Concern create a benefits and entitlement specialist team. There are four more non-attorney representatives now being able to do what I've been doing for Central City for the last several years. This team was created as a result of the incredible disability backlog and the high number of disabled citizens experiencing chronic homelessness. We got our start last March with grants from the Northwest Health Foundation, Providence Health Systems, and the City of Portland invested a wonderful amount of money through the Bureau of Housing and Community Development. They're the ones that administer Portland's 10-year plan to end homelessness. My team is known with some tongue-in-cheek as the best program for benefits and benefits and entitlement specialist team. Kind of a goofy acronym, I know. The BEST program was created to expedite the claims process for these tough homeless cases. Our unofficial motto is get it right the first time. We strive to not allow a case to go into the appeals process. Our results are remarkable thanks to the deliberate and thoughtful collaboration with the Social Security Administration and their adjudicators here in Salem. By the end of 2008, my team had reviewed 324 referrals. We'd enrolled 125 cases for lay representation. We obtained 40 decisions that took only an average of 42 days to adjudicate as opposed to 3-plus years.
How did you do that, Melanie?
having learned so much about the Social Security disability process, I was able to identify a lot of the areas that lay people or claimants weren't aware of how important the information was that the adjudicators needed. There's just a real disconnect on the information that they need to be able to make a Social Security disability decision and what people think they need to give them. So it's been a long and thoughtful process, and it's been working beautifully, and our relationship with the Social Security Administration and the Disability Determination Services has been incredible. It's been a wonderful program this last year, but I'll quickly move on. We've only had 6 denials in the whole last year, and we have not dipped below 87% approval rate so far on all the cases that we have submitted. And I didn't come down here to tell you too much more about this program other than it is new and there is some lay representation out there too. The normal percentage of claims from homeless people that get allowed at any part of the process, any part of the appeal or first stage, is 11 to 15%. So our 87% success rate means so much to people and our community as a whole. So I'm here today to express how great the need is for my help out there and yours. I've witnessed firsthand the incredible hardships of homelessness, disability, and poverty for over 8 years. When the previous general assistance program was terminated, so many of my clients were left to their own devices to scrape up enough money for their basic survival. It was a terrible day in Oregon's history. One consequence of its termination was a dramatic increase in panhandling and roadside begging that we've all witnessed. In our social service circles, folks that panhandle, we call that flying a sign. And many of my clients fly a sign. The BEST program got a little press last year, and I get calls regularly now from all sorts of service agencies, housing programs, hospitals, psychiatric wards, probation officers, all wanting to refer their clients or patients to me. We are not able to handle. Our numbers are small compared to the need out there.
Melanie, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up. And also, I can see you're reading from materials. It would be really helpful for us to have a copy of.
I did bring plenty of copies. I'll make sure and get them there for you.
Oh, great.
I got here a little late. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay. There was another lady that I was going to bring down. She was 60 years old. She called me, regrettably, late last afternoon. Her name is Phyllis Nelson, and she's 60 years old, and she really wanted to come down. She was in the workers' comp insurance industry for 21 years, and she actually does odd jobs now and then. She lives with her son, who can't support her either, and she had to take a job house-sitting and pet-sitting for an older friend of hers, and she wasn't able to come down. So I told her I'd make sure and let you guys know that she really wanted to be here also. General assistance was a lifeline for a lot of people, and if we can bring it back, it will become a lifeline again. And I just hope that we can keep fighting this good fight, and I thank you very much for being here and allowing me to be here to speak to you.
Thank you, Melanie.
Go ahead. I'll just say a couple words. I'm going to switch with you.
Oh, here. I can just... Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Nick Granum, part of the Recuperation Care Program with Central City Concern. And I'll just talk quickly. I see the people at the beginning of their time coming post-hospital. People are homeless and don't have a place to go when they leave the hospital. And we see a lot of people with no income. They have to make choices once they've recuperated between paying for their medications, paying for a place to live, paying for the various things they need to get around. We had somebody the other day who had a prescription they were given, $120 at the drugstore. They said, I really can't buy this medication. I have no income. There are programs to provide stopgaps in the community, but general assistance would help with that. It would help with just the basic things that in that period of time when people are becoming eligible for what they are eligible for, but they haven't gotten the paperwork going and they haven't made it happen yet. So in that there's always a bigger stop, a bigger break between the hospital and becoming self-sufficient than it seems like there should be. So
thank you, Nick.
That's it.
Never miss a chance to let people know, because you can't assume everything, but there are several prescription program assistance programs, the $4 prescriptions at all the main suspects, Fred Meyer, Rite Aid, Costco, and Walmart, and Walgreens. And there's also some of the drug companies have a program where they'll supply, you know, a few months' worth of prescription until the person can get on some of their assistance programs, if that's possible. And these are not outdated drugs. They're you know, current. You just walk in with it, so it's available, and it would be much less than the $100 a month. So.
Both Nick and I work in association with Old Town Clinic, a small FQHC in downtown Portland, and we are very aware of those programs,
okay.
And we try to get our folks hooked up to those as soon as possible. But there are some that are not covered, and a little extra money could help with that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you, gentlemen, for coming today. Appreciate it. Rosie Prophet. Marilyn Patton, Ellen Lowe, and Patty Whitney Wise. We have four chairs if you want to share those. Welcome. Whomever wants to go first.
Madam Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Rosie Prophet. My husband Dale and I have been caretakers for a grandson for several years. He was in a terrible accident in his senior year of high school, and among other injuries, actually had nerves pulled right out of his spine, and they tell us that this is one of the most excruciating pain injuries anybody can have. He had 11 surgeries since that time, and after each one, he just seems to get worse instead of better. He's in constant pain, even with the medications he's on. We've spent hundreds of hours writing letters, filling out paperwork, making phone calls, meeting with the different representatives from agencies like Oregon Health Plan, Social Services, Voc Rehab, Legal Aid, and Social Security. There were times when I really became so frustrated I didn't know if I could go on. It's a challenge just to get paperwork done, let alone all the agitation that goes along with it. But after nearly 4 years, after being turned down twice, he did get his Social Security disability. $630 a month is not enough to sustain him, but it's certainly a great help both to him and to us. It was actually somebody from Social Services that told us after the second turn down that we should see a Social Security attorney. And when we did, he told us that Social Security really doesn't like to give a disability to a young person, but he felt like that this was worth a try, and he took it on, and he was successful. At one point, he was getting money from Clackamas County Social Services, and that was such a thrill to him to think that he had his own money and did not have to rely on us for every single thing. It only lasted about 3 months because they run out of funding. And they really expressed their deep sorrow for having put him on that and have it turned away so quickly, but that was nothing that they could help. They were great to work with. They were very helpful to us. And with their rules and regulations, it just took time and effort to get all this done. You can't imagine the depression that a young person feels when their ability to sustain themselves is gone. He was an all-star athlete in high school, had all kinds of scholarships lined up for himself, and with this injury, of course, that all went by the wayside. He'd been a hard worker, made his own monies for his spending, and the depression that followed was just horrific. And the difference it made to have that little bit of income of his own was startling. I mean, there were times when he didn't even feel like he could get up out of bed in the mornings. And he actually told us that if it had not been for us, that he would have probably committed suicide. Not everybody is able to have someone that can help them, as we were blessed to do. I feel for these people, like the ones that have testified here, who have no one that will help them, that have not the means to do this. I hate to think what might have happened to our grandson if we hadn't been able to help him. And I feel so deeply for these other people, and I feel the program is so beneficial. I know just from the point of us who were not in the desperate situation that they are, that anything that you could do to get this program going not only would be appreciated by them, but by us as a society as a whole. There's so many programs that I, for one, feel are less important than trying to help those in such need. I thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for letting me testify here. I don't know that it really is pertinent to as far as some of the others were, but I'll be glad to answer any question that you might have.
Thank you so much for coming to testify. These human stories that we hear from our constituents and the citizens of Oregon are extremely important to us. So thank you for coming, and thank you for caring for your grandson. I'm going to hear all four of these, and then we'll have questions.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your willingness to listen to me this morning as I speak on an important issue. For the record, my name is Marilyn Patton. I live in Canby, Oregon. I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm also chair of the Clackamas County Area Agency on Aging Advisory Council. I'm here to express the strong support of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services for House Bill 2051. During the last 5 years, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services has made a number of community visits, sometimes with senior and people with disability staff and the local area agencies on aging. We've conducted community visits in 17 different communities around the state. During these visits, we had the opportunity to talk and listen to the concerns of local business leaders, including but not limited to senior center staff, district attorneys, hospital administrators, recipients of service, and other local people of interest. A Governor's Commission had dinner with some of the local leaders and legislators. We also visited a state-of-the-art assisted living in Ashland. Some of us had lunch at the local senior centers, during which time people gathered and would ask if we were the folks that they, quote, could tell their problems to, and we would talk to the governor, end quote. The Governor's Commission on Senior Services was tremendously impressed with the networking that occurs in the communities and how well people work together in complementing and stretching their resources. Local resources are, however, stretched to the maximum, and people are gravely concerned about the constant cuts to the senior and disability clientele. The local communities are the ones who will feel the brunt of cuts. The basic concern in the communities is the lack of a basic income for applicants of SSI and SSDI. The modest restoration contained in House Bill 2051 would greatly help with the basic needs of shelter, heat, food, and transportation. This restoration would also provide the necessary medical care so desperately needed. We all are aware of the enormous pressure on the general fund dollars. However, restoration of general assistance program would provide a direct infusion of funds into the local economies at this time of great need. The extra added attraction of the infusion of federal dollars is tantamount to the alleviation of some of the pressures on local resources. Other testimony has and will cover the program complexities of restoring this program, but the Governor's Commission is delighted to provide firsthand information to assist in your deliberation. I am available and happy to answer any questions you may have. And once again, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2051.
Thank you so much for coming today, and thanks for your service on the Commission. We really appreciate it. I'm going to go on to...
Would you... Sorry.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I'm pleased to be here today. I just want to summarize a few things from the testimony this morning. And first off, I just want to indicate that if you were concerned about the amount of food stamps that the gentleman on SSI was getting, we'll certainly look into that. Most SSI recipients receive quite a bit more in food stamps than $10. I know we were all impressed by the record with Central City Concern and their ability to get clients through the process fast, and I would just like to indicate two things. One, they're a unique program. We wish we had those kinds of programs all over Oregon. In many ways, the Department of Human Services can be that role for people if we restore this program. And if they take the findings from Central City Concern, that would definitely lower the cost of the program. They'd be getting people through much faster and recouping money much faster. And on the issue of costs, we are still working with the Department of Human Services. We still believe the cost is not quite so high, that there's a roll-up over the biennium so that it's not the full amount. And our calculations come out differently, so we're working with them on rectifying those numbers. So I wouldn't consider the cost hard numbers at this point, but something that we can work on. And then I also just want to be pragmatic for a minute. You've heard the stories of people and how important this kind of safety net program is for them to literally bring them out of the woods where we left many of them when this program ended in 2005. The pragmatic side is that we're leaving federal dollars on the table, a lot of federal money that would come in monthly to help these individuals and help our economy. And it certainly is much less costly than jails and emergency rooms, again, places where many of these folks end up because they have no resources to be able to support themselves and more likely to fall ill and have trouble just providing for basic needs. So for me, I wanted to at least appeal to that piece of the pragmatic side of what it means for the state of Oregon, not to mention the human cost that we're dealing these people on a daily basis. I would encourage you to appoint a working group with some of us and one or two of your members to really look at this program and come back with a solid proposal to move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty.
The first person whom I ever heard use the phrase poorest of the poor was Ellen Lowe. That stuck with me for years, Ellen.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today as a community advocate for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and also on behalf of the Community Mental Health Coalition. The populations that they serve are often those who meet the criteria that you have heard for general assistance. And too often, the emergency room or the crisis line is their entry point. And there are times when you do not want repeat business. And too often, there is repeat business of these populations to our crisis services, to the emergency room. And it's often because there isn't that kind of support service available to them when they leave the emergency room or the crisis service area. There are not funds for them to have an address. And unless you have a relationship, which some of our hospitals do, with Central City Concern, for recuperative care, there isn't that continuum of service that allows people to be well enough so that indeed they can participate then in gaining SSI or SSDI. I'm one of those who at times have tried to help people get through the process. And believe me, it is complicated and it is lengthy. And so I wish that there had been the kind of tutoring available to me about 15 years ago that I heard that Central City Concern is now offering. I want to pick up on something that Patty Whitney Wise just said, and that's that really what we're talking about is something which is quite pragmatic. In the work that we did for the Oregon Health Fund Board, there was considerable attention given to bending the curve, bending the costs of health care. And one of those things that was so often alluded to was chronic disease management and the importance of having that available, which in turn then would lower the costs of health care for all of us. We really see that what general assistance would offer would be those wraparound services, would be the ability then to assist folks so that they would no longer be that emergency repeat business. Their contact with the health system would be maintenance. And it would, so we see it as a cost-effective way of not only lowering health care costs for all of us, but more important, being able to be very humane in what we do provide for the poorest of the poor. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Any questions of anyone on this panel?
Well, this is a thought, and I'm sure you all have done it, and everybody in this room, but maybe this committee could write to our federal delegation and ask them, now that things are all shaken up out there in Washington, D.C., they could work on speeding up this process and use Melanie's ideas if they're applicable and maybe save some money in the process.
Mm-hmm. Just an idea. Mm-hmm. Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, and this is for Ellen, is regarding the chronic care issue, and can you just elaborate on how integrated health homes might be of assistance in this process of dealing with chronic disease management?
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, I believe there's great potential in the kind of integration which is taking place in some areas where it's in response to community collaboratives, but certainly what Care Oregon has been able to do, and actually the Old Town Clinic and Central City Concern have been part of that also in Portland, where you do have maybe not in one place, but you do develop the capacity for communication among all the health care providers. And I'm not sure that it's been mentioned today, but over half of those who are going on to SSI are living with mental illness. And so it is extremely important that you have a connection of what too often we think of as just physical health, but we have that with mental health. And I know the community collaborative legislation that you worked on in the last, both last regular session and then the extended session, and I hope it continues this time, really offers that kind of ability to be there where the people are.
Madam Chair, that was just a shameless plug for House Bill 2131 and Senate Bill 456.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to take a lot of time, but I just have to comment on sort of a collection of things that we've been hearing, and I appreciate all of the testimony we've heard and all of the work that folks are doing. I hope that we can integrate our thinking as well as we look at this whole picture. I focus a lot on the services that are available in rural communities, and to get back to something that Nicole mentioned, much of this kind of service delivery could and was done through the area agencies on aging, which we do have in our areas if it were available once again, and if we could cut down the amount of time that it takes people to become eligible to somewhere between the current time frame and the amazing time frame that Central City Concern has, how much more quickly we could begin to recover those federal funds, as Patty was referring to. So there's just a lot of excellent points that have been made today, and I hope that we can kind of get our thinking around all of them as we carry the case forward for this bill, because there's a lot of pieces of that whole question, and I just needed to share that. Thank you
I'm
for giving
me
the
time. I'm so glad you did, Representative Cowan. Thank you. Any further questions?
No, I just want to comment, too, something that has occurred to me, and especially during the storm and emergency disasters we've had, and I represent rural areas, and our sheriff's department have really stepped up, and I know for a fact that my two that were hit hardest, Tillamook and Clatsop, the sheriff's department and their employees have worked around the clock to go out and do welfare checks on people, and welfare meaning see how they're doing, and people who are known to live alone or have health issues, and even the guys out in the hills, when it gets bad, they come down. And so even our local store near where I live took people in just to be coming in out of the cold,
And as people came in and out of the store to buy gas or supplies, because they did have generator power when it went out, people were able to say, oh, why don't you come home with me? We're having dinner tonight or whatever. And these kind of safety nets that exist in other rural areas that may not exist in the cities do kind of pick up some of the pieces in tough times.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you so much for your testimony today, and we'll be following up on these issues. We have Ruth McEwen. Am I pronouncing that correct? All right, Ruth. Ryan Fisher, Devin Russo, and did we already have Jeanette, right?
No,
a different Jeanette.
We have Deanne. Yeah.
Okay, Jeanette Pengrath. Ruth, I'm going to let you just go right ahead.
Chair Tomei and committee, my name is Ruth McEwen. I'm from Salem, and I'm representing the Northwest Senior and Disability Services Advisory Council members. And we support 2051, which restores general assistance. We also are concerned that with the restoration of this program, that we receive the staffing that's based on the real workload and not put more workload on the staff that we already have. We also realize that this will provide cash, medical assistance, and case management to single or childless adults with disabilities who have few assets and are in the process of applying for Social Security benefits. And as with the previous program, it provides the state can be reimbursed by the federal government for the funds an individual receives from the GA. In other words, recipients are loaned money from the state until they get their federal assistance and the state is repaid. Under the budget reduction review principles developed in 2009, the Joint Ways and Means the Senate Bill 250 adheres to the committee's principle, maximizing the use of federal dollars as Oregons may claim reimbursement for the cash assistance for GA. And before it was cut previously, the program provided a small cash grant to cover needs such as Oregon health plan, medical services, and access to food stamps. The funds went to individuals without access to unemployment compensation, private disability, or workers' compensation. For these Oregonians, the GA program provided temporary help to those with desperate needs. The Ways and Means Committee also stated that they would put human safety issues first for people with disabilities who have no other means of income and few assets. The GA program is their safety net. For these reasons, we believe that the Oregon needs to reinstate the GA program and fund staffing for the additional work that's involved.
Thank you for coming, Ruth, and thanks for your testimony.
And I'd like to add a caveat to it,
Beth,
in that when I applied for SSDI, it took me 28 months to get mine.
When was that?
It was in the 80s, but it's still that way now.
Yes, we can see that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I represent the Community Action Partnerships of Oregon. I'm here today to speak in favor of HB 2051. I'll be very brief. As you know, the community action agencies are throughout the state and oftentimes receive the first calls for help from families when they are in times of need. The piece of information that I will add is just about the general climate right now of need in the state. I was speaking with one of our directors earlier this week, and she said that in Baker County last month, 91% of the people who contacted them for assistance with housing, it was the first time that they had ever asked for any type of assistance. And so there is a climate right now that is bringing a lot of people to these safety nets that have never been there before. And so with that, I will just say that we are definitely supportive of this because we feel that it is a very important part of the safety net, and we wanted to join our voice into this chorus of folks who are speaking today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. My name is Devin Russo, and I'm a client advocate with Cascade AIDS Project in Portland, Oregon. Thank you, first of all, for having this open forum to restore Oregon's General Assistance Program and House Bill 2051. Many of the clients that I assist are very ill. Suffering from AIDS is only one of the health factors that they are coping with on a daily basis. Of these, the majority are homeless and have come to rely on emergency rooms for their sole source of medical care. This creates an undue burden on taxpayers and medical providers attempting to provide comprehensive health care in an environment that is not set up for primary care. A number of these clients that I serve are in the process of applying for disability. While they wait, they must live on the street or in shelters where they seldom are able to take HIV medications that could save their lives because there is little or no security to keep these expensive medications safe. In order for antiretrovirus medications to be effective, they must be taken with a 90% compliance rate or better. This is hardly attainable on the street or in shelters. Stability is needed to create an effective and safe environment for clients to enter into and maintain their health care while they wait to get on to disability. General assistance funds would provide clients with severe HIV infection who are waiting for disability benefits to pay for very modest housing in a single-room occupancy hotel or apartments. This stability would give them a chance to engage in primary medical care, take effective HIV medications, and live in a much healthier environment with dignity. These stabilized clients would be able to concentrate on their medical needs instead of worrying about where they will sleep. It will eliminate the need for costly visits to the emergency room and make existing health care for clients much more effective. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Devin. I see that you had written testimony. If you could give that to the administrator, that would be great, and we'll make sure that it gets to everybody here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of anyone in this panel?
I just wanted to point out that in Ruth's testimony, she highlights that this does adhere to ways and means criteria for funding in that, and it saves money with the federal, and it's kind of more of a loan than a general grant.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Thank you. Thank you all very much for coming and for testifying today. Jeanette Pengraff, is she here? She'll find out. Okay. Is there anyone else? We can take another couple minutes if anyone else wishes to testify. All right. Is John still here?
Yes.
John, you had suggested, and so did other people, that we put together a task force, and I'm willing to do that. I've asked a couple of legislators to be involved in that task force, Representative Freeman and Representative Dembro. And whom else would you suggest being on?
SPD is, Madam Chair, of course. And then our steering committee is made up of myself and Nicole Armstrong and Patty Whitney Wise and Stephanie Thomas Sweet. So I think the four of us meeting with legislators and SPD would probably be an excellent work group.
Terrific. And I'm assuming you will be contacting them and you can set up a time to meet.
Yes, we will.
Great.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you all who came to testify today, and thanks for all who came to listen. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2051 and open up a hearing on House Bill, a work session on House Bill 2135. Keely?
2135 requires rental agreements to indicate whether smoking is prohibited on the rental property, whether it's allowed, or if it's allowed only in specific areas on the property. where smoking is allowed on the premises, it requires rental agreement to warn of possible exposure to secondhand smoke. We have two amendments. 2135-2 actually encompasses the changes made in 2135-1. It removes the requirements that landlords warn about exposure to secondhand smoke, and it exempts owner-occupied mobile homes and houseboats where they occupy a rental space, and adds the requirement that this information be added to the statutes concerning the terms of rental agreements and the segment of the Oregon statutes concerning smoke detection.
Thank you, Keeley. And I think everybody has been given these amendments ahead of time. Is there anyone here who wishes to testify? Can we do that, can't we?
Yes.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify about the amendments?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Rental Housing Association in support of the Dash 2 amendments. Following our first hearing on the bill, we worked on what came back as the Dash 1. We had to revise that because the Landlord-Tenant Coalition looked at the amendment and wanted the requirement to be under two statutes, Chapter 479, which is the Smoke Detector Fire Safety Statute, as well as Chapter 90. And so that's why the Dash 2 amendments essentially is the agreement that we had with DHS and the advocates of the bill, essentially is a rewrite of the bill, and we would urge the committee to adopt the Dash 2 amendments.
Great. Thank you so much, Sean. Any questions of Sean?
And maybe I haven't studied this enough, but if it removes the requirement that landlords warn about possible exposure to smoke, what does it do anymore?
Other than Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I think the intent of the bill was to require landlords to have a smoking policy in their lease and all agreements. And so it would essentially have that disclosure to where any tenant that comes in, they would understand and know whether it's a no smoking house or apartment building, or if there is smoking, where that particular where it would be allowed. And so it's, I think, some of the confusion or from the advocate side is that a tenant may come in, never know what the smoking policy is, find out that there is people smoking in the facility or not. I guess there was just a question of whether they know or not. And so this, it's like they clearly have an understanding of where they're, what they're getting into, what they're renting. And like I said, a lot of our landlords are moving to no smoking policies anyway, just from a liability purposes. But having this in the agreement, I think, is good not only for the landlord but for the tenant. And so we would urge the Dash 2 amendment adoption.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Did that answer your question? I think I can clarify sort of, for you.
Yeah, okay.
Part of the issue was that the first bill would have required a warning that you might encounter secondhand smoke. Mm-hmm. Now that warning language is all that's been removed. You still have to disclose whether or not this is a smoking facility, a non-smoking facility, or it allows smoking. It just deletes that warning language, and so you don't have to warn of secondhand smoke.
And warn of the danger of secondhand
right.
smoke. And that was
right.
one of the issues.
Madam Chair.
We have two more questions before you.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, right. Representative Dimbro, and then Representative Maurer, and then Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on a point that I raised when we first heard this, many facilities are in process of going smoke-free. And so we could have, we could have situations in which some units have smokers and others don't. And one could potentially be moving into a unit that's right next to someone who does, where the person is still smoking. And so when the language talks about areas on the premises where smoking is allowed, how specific do you see these disclosures being so that a person could know that they're actually moving next door to somebody who's smoking? That is, I would be afraid that the areas where smoking allowed could be so general that it may not give the individual the kind of guidance that they need. So I'm wondering what kind of advice you're going to be giving to the tenants, the landlords, rather.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative D'Ambrella, I think a landlord is, from a lease agreement standpoint, gets pretty specific when they get into the guidelines and things that they hand actually a tenant. And so, I would suggest, and I know the folks who train landlords around the state on how to do things legally, I think the more detail and the more, when talking about where which premises they may smoke or not, I think they would be pretty detailed on that particular incident. But again, that's up to the landlord. And so I think it's from the tenant standpoint who comes in and applies, has the application, the landlord goes through exactly, given the premises and what they're doing. It's the tenant's then choice, I believe, to kind of make that, do they want to live there or not? And I think that's the intent of Section 2. I don't know, again, given the detail, I can't determine how every single landlord might do that, but I think that's the intent of Section 2. And I understand your concerns. I just don't know how to, I guess, fully answer that, since a lot of that's their decision.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Is the use of medical marijuana considered smoking?
Wow. Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I don't know the answer to that question, other than it is illegal if you do carry that legal card, and so I would have to ask that question. I don't know, and maybe others in the audience may know that question.
Madam Chair, yeah. Actually, under 475.328. It just says, if medical marijuana administered under this subsection is smoked, adequate ventilation must be provided. And I don't want to stop this conversation. I don't want to stop this bill at all based on any questions. But I guess my question is, how do landlords deal with this issue? Because they couldn't prohibit it because it's medical. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's the intent of that, but how do they deal with it?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I don't know the answer to that, and I have not heard too many landlords bring that up.
Okay.
To our folks at the association, but I'm happy to ask some of the members, I think, that would probably deal with these situations, and okay. So I'm happy to get that information.
And Madam Chair, my intent is not to stop mm-hmm. it.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With apologies, I didn't see hands on the other side of me. wouldn't be one to come in. But actually, the reason I jumped in at the moment I did was because I think that in the staff summary, as we've gone on to sort of detail some of the information about involuntary tobacco smoke and what its effects are, and then it sort of led us to the conclusion that the line that's of concern about disclosure to the tenant is in the original bill is broader than what the bill actually says, because it doesn't say anything about and the effects of that are going to be. It just says disclosure shall include a warning to the tenant that the tenant may be exposed to secondhand smoke while on the premises. It doesn't say anything about what that
how
means
that
to
yeah.
you. So I think that clarity is important in what the original bill said, and that gets us then to a discussion of the -2 amendments. And I can probably live with them because I think it's important enough for this bill to go forward. I do think that disclosure of the smoking policy that tells where it's allowed and where it isn't and that sort of thing can draw your own conclusions about how close you are. The one question that it leaves in my mind
You know, I think these are issues probably.
I'm getting to a question.
Got it.
Right now.
Go ahead.
The one question that leaves in my mind is, from the landlord's perspective, would it be acceptable to include some directive about having to disclose how long the current existing smoking policy has been in place? In other words, did the landlord implement that policy yesterday or 2 years ago? Because that would make a big difference to me if I were a prospective tenant in moving into an apartment that might or might not have had smoking allowed in it in a fairly recent time frame. This is not a make it or break it for me on this bill, but I'm just curious. Thank you.
You bet.
For indulging me.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, I think I would have to go back to the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which has the landlord and the tenant advocates to have that discussion. If it was a no-smoking facility, obviously I don't think that would pertain. I think, and just to clarify the question, I think you're saying if maybe it was a no-smoking facility and then went to a smoking facility? Is that?
No, I'm saying I'll clarify my question.
Or the other
if
way
it
around.
Was a smoking facility and then recently become a non-smoking facility. Now, and I want to make sure I make a distinction. The exposure to secondhand smoke needs to be right now while someone is smoking and I'm inhaling it. There's a secondary personal consideration about whether a unit has had smoking allowed in it in the last month versus 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess I don't know how to answer that question, whether we would want to put in a policy or not in there or not. I would have to probably go back to my group and ask them. I know that just the original concern was, you know, they want to have the disclosure. They want tenants to at least understand what they're getting into, because I think that was the primary, push for this bill.
Yeah.
And we were obviously agreeable to putting that in there in our lease and requirement. As for some of the details of, I know, existing tenants and how they may roll over based on your policy, I understand where you're going, and that may be difficult for the landlord to administer. And it's probably hard to go to an existing tenant and tell them, by the way, you know, it's no smoking. I think they have the prerogative to do that, and I think a lot of them would do that. If they decide to take a whole apartment complex and say no smoking, they can change the lease. They have to give notice, a proper notice, and a proper time frame under the state law, but they could could make those decisions even now if they're smoking.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Very quick thing. We can have the coalition come up and discuss this.
Okay, I will, because I'm sorry you said that, because that then rolls me into, well, if there's a no-smoking policy in the unit, but you have individuals who signed up under a different thing and are still smoking next door, that raises. So I'd appreciate the coalition would address that.
We will.
Thank you.
Do that. Thank you so much,
Sean. Yep.
And who from the coalition would like to come up and talk about these?
Sybil.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center. We represent low-income clients across the state of Oregon, and we do a lot of work with tenants. We're members of the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, to which Sean was referring, and we did have input and discussion onto this bill, along with the Department of Human Services and Ms. Lauder. So we are appreciative of and supportive of the bill as it stands with the amendments. I think, as Sean was explaining, the purpose is to provide some notice to tenants and to let them know what it is that they might be getting into and to give them an opportunity to ask questions if they want further information. So the policies would delineate, and I think Sean made the point that landlords have an interest in clearly delineating what the policies are, because they want to know what it is that they can enforce again, you know, with their tenants, and tenants need to know what their behavior, what is expected of them and what's prescribed. And so I think we expect that there will be clear policies and will help to provide support in developing those. And we work closely with some of the landlord associations in providing education and outreach. So I think from the tenant perspective, we're happy that there is this notice so that tenants can then engage in discussion should they want further information. And I don't know if there are other specific questions. But
any questions of this witness?
That satisfies me. Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Representative Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments that are dated February 9th, 2009.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated February 9th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Thank you, Representative Olson. Representative.
And then, Madam Chair, I move also then House Bill 2135 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2135 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I know there was some discussion possibly on wanting to place this on the consent calendar at one time.
Oh, no.
No? Yeah, you'd want to have discussion, I would think.
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. You would have objected to that, I assume.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, okay. All right. Seeing no objections, will the clerk call the roll? And start at the bottom of the alphabet instead of the top. But I'll be last. Pardon?
Representative Cowan.
Hi.
That's the bottom.
She's not never the bottom.
Next time you can start from the bottom.
It was my maiden name that he's thinking
of.
We don't want to go there.
That's fine, Zach. Aye.
Representative Dimbrough.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
You bet.
Representative
Mallett.
Aye. Representative Van Orman.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Olson.
Affirmative.
Vice Chair Boone.
Betcha, by golly, wow.
Chair Tomac.
Aye. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Motion passes.
Motion passes, and this bill passes. Thank you. Who would like to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Representative Deborah, you haven't carried a bill yet, have you?
I've not.
Oh, then why don't you carry this?
Okay.
All right.
With that, I
close the hearing on House Bill 2135. Thank you, colleagues. You've done a good job, and we're out 17 minutes early. And with that, anything for the good of the order? Representative Power.
The note I wrote you.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to mention to the members of the committee who weren't able to attend this morning's breakfast forum with the Senior and Disability Caucus. Shared this morning was a Econ Northwest study of the economic impacts around long-term care or changes in the long-term care sector that, and I'm not talking to you two because you were there, that will be delivered to you. It's very, very compelling information. Their estimate is average job losses for every $1 million that we don't spend in this arena. Are 34, which have a disproportionate, in this industry, impact on women. And many of the long-term care segment of the industry have been working on doing some in-house training to allow people to climb the career ladder. It is one of the few job sectors that's experiencing growth at this particular point. So I think that those are all very important factors as we move forward in our really difficult conversations about community-based long-term care for seniors and people with disability. And this particular group will be continuing that discussion of particularly workforce impacts at their next meeting, which will be March 11th. They meet at 7 o'clock on whatever Wednesday of the month this is, second Wednesday of the month. You'll be getting information, but I did want to highlight that.
Thank you for that information.
Yes, Representative Boone.
What was that figure again for every $1 million?
that's cut?
That's cut back in support of this. There's a 34. There's 34 jobs lost because these are not the highest sector, highest paying jobs, and a huge disproportionate impact on females versus males, some of whom are heads of household, and in an industry where most of the job earnings go directly back into community. They don't go into savings, they go into buying groceries and those kinds of things. So there's some interesting detail in this report, and I know so many things just sort of get brought to our offices that I wanted to highlight that you might want to take a look at.
You know, it'd be really helpful if that's a one-pager that you were referring
to. No, it was not a one-pager. It was notes on the back page.
Okay, okay.
Well, everybody is going to have a copy of this.
And it's not that big a book. It's kind of a little book.
Yeah.
And people with lots of pictures. People will be happy to give you some additional talking points if anybody wants them.
Terrific. Thank you. Anything else for the good of the order here?
I'm ready.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for indulging me.
Health Committee on Human Services.